Hello everyone, so my name is Brian, as Phil said, and I work here at the Aldersgate Talks. I grew up in Hong Kong, and I'm of ethnic Chinese descent, and yeah, my family still live there, and they are Christians. Before we dive into the story of how Christianity came to China, I'd just like to share one verse from the Bible which will help us to understand the story better. Now, if you look down at your notice sheets, on the other side there's an outline of today's talk. So under introduction, you'll see the Bible verse printed for us. Now, let me read it. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So this verse comes from John's Gospel, which is an eyewitness account of Jesus' life. Jesus is talking about his upcoming death in Jerusalem. He will be nailed to a cross and crucified by the Roman authorities. Without his death, he remains the only Son of God. But through his death, it will bring forth a harvest of fruit. In other words, sons of the devil will become the sons of God. A new family of God will be created. This will be the birth of the Christian church. From 12 disciples, it will grow to become a movement spanning the whole globe, every continent, every country. And that is why there is a church here in the UK. That is why there is a church in China. And the same principle of death leading to life also applies to Jesus' followers, not just to Jesus himself. Jesus says in verse 26, if anyone serves me, he must follow me. So Jesus is saying that if we want to follow Jesus, we must follow in his footsteps. We must follow his example. Jesus' followers must die to themselves and live for God. Dying to self is usually metaphorical, but in some cases it will be physical. God will use the sacrifices of Christians to bring forth fruit, that is, more disciples. And we see the evidence of this throughout the history of the church. We certainly see this in the story of the church in China. Missionaries who gave up everything to bring the good news of Jesus Christ to the people of China. And God honored their sacrifices. The church in China today is huge, somewhere between 40 and 100 million believers. It has possibly overtaken the number of Communist Party members in China. Well, how did this all happen? Well, let's travel back in time. So phase one, the arrival of Syriac Christianity. This is our first point. The Assyrian church, which is also known as the Church of the East, began to send missionaries to China back in the 7th century. The main religions in China at the time were Buddhism and Taoism, an indigenous Chinese folk religion. A guy called Bishop Alopen from Syria brought the Bible to China and gave it as a gift to the emperor. The emperor of the time, Taizong of the Tang dynasty, read the Bible and approved of its message. He recognized that it was a book of truth, and he ordered it to be preached and transmitted throughout China. Alopen was allowed to establish churches in Xi'an, which was the capital of China at the time. The Christian faith spread, and many became Christians. But how do we actually know this? Well, there's an 8th century stone tablet known as the Xi'an Stele, which was discovered in 1625. It contains a detailed record of the arrival of Christianity in China. This tablet has been well preserved, and you can still go and see it today in Xi'an. The tablet also describes the beliefs of the church. The Syriac Church, the Church of the East, has a reputation of subscribing to the teachings of Nestorius, a heretic. He taught that Jesus was not fully God and fully man at the same time. Rather, Jesus had two distinct natures, one human and the other divine. And so this meant that Jesus is only united with the Son and is not the Son of God himself. But the tablet shows us that the Christians in China did not actually follow this teaching. On the contrary, it shows us that they believed in the typical Trinitarian descriptions of God and Christ that Christians today believe in. So for example, the terms San Yi Fen Shen, which is another way of describing the Trinity, is used. And furthermore, the tablet shows that these early Christians in China held orthodox beliefs in the basic gospel message. From the creation of the world, to the fall in the Garden of Eden, to the coming of Jesus Christ, his crucifixion and resurrection, these Christians believed in the same gospel message that the Bible puts forth. Interestingly, they also used Buddhist and Taoist language to explain their beliefs, but they were only done so to communicate these new ideas in ways that were familiar to the Chinese people at the time. Sadly, though, religious freedom did not last long for these Christians. In the year 845, the Empress of China banned all Western religions. And these included Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, as well as Christianity. All of their assets were given over to the state. This would not be the last time that Christianity was banned in China. In the year 986, a monk reported to the patriarch of the Eastern Church, "Christianity is extinct in China. The native Christians have perished. The church has been destroyed, and there is only one Christian left in the land." So we now move on to phase two. In 1517, Martin Luther, a German monk, launched the Protestant Reformation in Germany. And in response to that, the Roman Catholic Church launched the Counter-Reformation. And as part of this movement, the Jesuits was formed. The Jesuits were a missionary society, and they sent missionaries all over the world, including to China. They were so entrepreneurial, they even found a training college for missionaries in Macau, which was on the southern tip of China. This college taught subjects such as theology, philosophy, maths, geography, astronomy, as well as Latin, Portuguese, and Chinese. It also included a school of music and arts, so creating very well-rounded missionaries who were not only educated in the Bible, but they could speak Chinese, and they were musical and artistic and scientific. And these subjects proved to be really important in winning the respect of the Chinese elites. And we'll hear more about that in a minute. The most famous Jesuit missionary was called Matteo Ricci. He is still very well known today in China as Li Ma Dou. He was an Italian Jesuit who arrived in Macau in 1582. There were some Chinese converts in Macau at this time. Once Ricci had mastered the Chinese language, he moved inland to Guangdong province and established a Jesuit mission there. With the help of colleagues, he compiled a Chinese-Portuguese dictionary. This was the first ever dictionary that consisted of both Chinese and another European language. At first, Ricci dressed as a Buddhist monk to show that he was a religious man from the West, hoping to gain respect from the local population. But he soon found out that the Chinese educated classes actually looked down on Buddhist monks. They were seen as foreign and superstitious. And instead, they respected scholars of the Confucian tradition. Confucius was a 6th century BC philosopher in China, and he was massively influential. And so Ricci decided to stop dressing as a Buddhist monk, but instead to dress as a Confucian scholar. He also tried very hard to reconcile Christianity with classic Confucian texts. And in 1601, Ricci was actually able to meet the Chinese emperor in Beijing. He was even invited to become a special advisor to the imperial court. His whole approach was quite subtle. He would impress the emperor and his court with Western technology and learning. For example, he presented a telescope as well as a map of the world to the emperor. These objects were completely new to the Chinese, and they were fascinated by them. And so, having won the favor of the emperor, Ricci established a church in Beijing that would actually become the Catholic Cathedral. It is still in operation today. He also went about preaching the gospel to the Chinese elites. The most notable convert was a man called Xu Guangqi, who rose to become one of the cabinet ministers in the Ming court. Ricci and Xu worked closely together to spread the Christian faith. They were gospel partners. Ricci taught Xu things about the Bible and the Christian faith, and Xu in turn introduced Ricci to other influential figures in the Chinese court, some of whom became Christians as well. Ricci worked very hard, and he died in 1610. And amazingly, he was granted permission by the emperor to be buried in Beijing. He was actually the first ever Westerner to have been given this privilege. All other missionaries before, or all other Westerners, had been buried in Macau. He was the first to be buried in Beijing, and you can still go and visit his grave today. The Jesuit mission went on to become an important part of the imperial civil service in China right into the 18th century. In 1644, a German Jesuit, Adam Charles von Bell, was appointed director of the Board of Astronomy by the new Qing dynasty. Jesuits were also given posts as mechanics, musicians, painters, instrument makers, and in other areas that required technical expertise. I remember I said earlier that the Jesuits had founded a missionary college in Macau, teaching these different subjects to missionaries, so they really came in handy because they enabled Jesuits to secure important positions in the imperial civil service, and therefore to influence, you know, the emperor and the officials with the Christian message. And so the development of Catholic Christianity in China started an interesting process of cultural and artistic crossover. However, as the number of Catholic converts grew, tensions arose. In particular, there was a debate about whether converts to Christianity were allowed to offer incense to their ancestors. This was an ancient custom that had been practiced by the Chinese for hundreds of years. Confucius, the philosopher that I mentioned earlier, had taught that filial piety, in other words, showing respect to your elders, was hugely important to the maintenance of a proper society. And therefore, offering incense to your ancestors was an expression of this. There was a split between the Catholics regarding the appropriateness of this conduct. The Jesuits argued, yes, it was legitimate to offer incense to your ancestors. But the Dominicans and the Franciscans, two other Catholic mission orders, argued no, it was against the Bible's teaching. In the end, this dispute was brought to the Pope's attention in Rome. He was like the Supreme Court of the Catholic Church. His judgment was the final answer. And what was his answer? It was no. Catholics should not be allowed to offer incenses to their ancestors, as this was perceived as ancestor worship, and therefore against the second commandment in the Bible. The Chinese emperor was incensed by this ban. He accused the Pope of being ignorant and bigoted, and as a result, he banned Catholic activities in China. All missionaries were expelled from the country. This would not be the last time that this would happen. Eventually, in 1724, Catholicism as a religion was banned across China. Catholics went underground. Missionaries would still arrive from Europe, but they would conduct their activities covertly. Those who were caught, and they were caught, were executed by the authorities. Chinese Christians who refused to recant their faith were sent to Muslim cities in Xinjiang, the far western province of China, and they were given as slaves to Muslim masters. We come now to the third and final phase of Christianity in China, Protestant Christianity. The first Protestant missionary in China was Robert Morrison of the London Missionary Society. He grew up in Northumbria, and he began work in Macau in 1807. He had to learn Chinese secretly, as it was illegal for foreigners to do so. He somehow managed to find a teacher who was brave enough to teach him Chinese, and he had to do it at night to avoid being discovered. So it was a very secretive process. It was also a lonely experience for him. At one point, he wrote in his diary, "There is no one here in China who I would consider a friend, but I have the Lord Jesus Christ, so I am not alone. With his help, I shall carry on with this important work." And his perseverance paid off. He mastered Chinese and was eventually able to translate the Bible into Chinese in 1813 with the help of others. And in the following year, 1814, he baptized the first ever Protestant convert, Tai Ke. Tai was one of the craftsmen who worked on the publishing of the Bible. He probably read it as he was working on it and became convinced of its message. It just shows how powerful the Bible is and how it can really change someone's life. And then in 1823, around 10 years later, he commissioned the first Chinese pastor called Liang Fa. Morrison was soon joined by other missionaries from Europe, and he even got married to one of them. However, very sadly, within a few years, his colleagues and his wife had all died. And yet, he soldiered on with the help of the Lord Jesus. Over time, he established schools and newspapers to publicize the Christian faith. And he died in 1834. Now, as late as 1860, Protestant missions were only confined to 5 cities on the coast in China. By the end of the century, the 19th century, Western missionaries were allowed into the interior. And so during the second half of the 19th century, increasing numbers of missionaries entered the country. Hudson Taylor's China Inland Mission sent out pioneering missionaries to the vast hinterlands of China. I was just chatting to one of us about Hudson Taylor. He's very well known amongst Christians in the West and also in China. Hudson Taylor was a Yorkshireman who said that if he had 1,000 lives, he would give them all to the Chinese. He loved China, and he gave up his whole life to serve the Chinese. These missionaries from the China Inland Mission, including the famous Cambridge Seven and the cricketer C.T. Studd, adopted a new approach. They actually chose to wear Chinese dress, and the men even grew pigtails. The aim was to persuade the Chinese that Christianity was not a Western religion, but rather a religion for the Chinese. And God greatly blessed their efforts, and new churches were set up in all of the inland provinces of China. Besides the London Missionary Society of Robert Morrison and the China Inland Mission founded by Hudson Taylor, there were lots of other missionaries affiliated with the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Anglicans, and the Wesleyans. Most of these missionaries came from countries such as England, America, Sweden, France, Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. So it was an international effort. And in addition to the publication and distribution of Christian literature and Bibles, the Protestant missionary movement in China furthered the dispersion of knowledge with other printed works of history and science. As the missionaries went to work amongst the Chinese, They established and developed schools and introduced the latest techniques in medicine. The mission schools were actually viewed with suspicion by traditional Chinese teachers, but then they were pioneering in offering a basic education to poor people, both boys and girls, who had no hope of learning at a school. Protestants in China were also the first in establishing clinics and hospitals. They provided the first training for nurses. They worked to abolish practices such as foot binding, and they sought to improve the treatment of maids. They launched charitable work and distributed food to the poor. They opposed the opium trade, and they brought treatment to many who were addicted to it. Some of the early leaders of the Chinese Republic, which came after the Qing Dynasty, such as Sun Yat-sen, were converts to Christianity, and they were influenced greatly by its teachings. Just like in phase two, persecution soon came to the church. In the year 1900, there was a massacre of missionaries and Chinese Christians throughout northern China. This was known as the Boxer Rebellion. There was a brutal anti-foreign and anti-Christian policy that was implemented in one of the inland provinces known as Shanxi. 44 foreigners, including women and children from missionary families, were invited to the provincial capital, and they were massacred by the governor. This was known as the Taiyuan Massacre. The Baptist Missionary Society, which was based in England, had opened its mission in Shanxi in 1877. In 1900, all of its missionaries there were killed, along with 120 converts. By the summer's end, more foreigners and as many as 2,000 Chinese Christians have been put to death in the province. This massacre of Christians has been called the greatest single tragedy in the history of Chinese evangelicalism. During the Boxer Rebellion as a whole, a total of 136 Protestant missionaries and 53 children were killed, 47 Catholic priests and nuns, 30,000 Chinese Catholics, 2,000 Chinese Protestants, and 200 to 400 of the Russian Orthodox Christians in Beijing were estimated to have been killed. These Christians who died are known as the Chinese martyrs of 1900. However, after the rebellion ended, missionaries continued their efforts of spreading the gospel in China, and the church grew even more rapidly. And my own ancestors were converted through these missionaries in the early 1900s. They then moved to Hong Kong and were buried in the Christian cemetery there. Now, two of my uncles are now retired Christian ministers in the Anglican Church of Hong Kong. And my hope is to return to Hong Kong as well in a few years' time to serve in the church there. Just to share a few reflections on this. As I said at the start, Jesus' death on the cross gave rise to the church. His death brought life to millions of people around the world. And following in his footsteps, these Christian missionaries gave up everything, including their families, their homes, their careers, and ultimately, for many, even their lives, to bring the good news of Jesus Christ to the people of China. Their sacrifices were greatly used by God to bring forth fruits in China. And as we look at the church today with millions of believers, we give thanks to God for these men and women who gave up their lives to serve the people of China. But what about the future of the church? Well, I'm full of confidence that God will continue to grow the church in China. As we've seen, the church has experienced great persecution, a lot of opposition, and yet it has grown and grown, and today it is the largest that it has ever been. And so, my prediction is that it will continue to grow and it will even be sending missionaries to other parts of the world and bringing the gospel to people who have never heard it before. Thank you very much for listening.